It's easy for us to say that someone else is amazing when they gather their strength and willpower in order to achieve great things. Instead, we should take the lessons we learn from them and apply it to our own lives. Open our eyes to our own potential. Welcome to the Defending Vision podcast, where this blind man shows you exactly how he sees it. Hardship, humor, and keeping a vision alive. Throw on some headphones for the full audio experience. Today, we continue our conversation with Daria Zawadzki and Isaac Lidsky. Go back to the previous episode to hear part one of our discussion if you missed it. Welcome to the conversation. On a lighter note, I suppose, so today, both of you are married with children. I think probably just about every blind person has had the thought of how is anybody going to really look past this? But it sounds like, you know, both of you did find someone. What was the moment where you said, okay, this person has really looked past it and just sees me for me?
Well, I mean, I love that question, because Joe and I have been together for 30 years, and we met when we were 20. We're 50 this year, and awesome. It was never an issue for him. Mm. And I couldn't have contemplated that. Like, it didn't make sense to me for years. I had to accept it. It took me longer, you know, than it took him. And I really think that's what real love is, not meaning to sound cheesy, because everyone comes with a mixed bag of stuff, you know? So sure. I think anyone, regardless of what it is, you know, can find someone, and there's no guarantee for anyone. So,
right.
But definitely I felt very, very lucky to have met someone, you know, where it just wasn't an issue. That was not an issue. And on the contrary, like he will tell me at least that he's very proud of how I navigate my life, and he thinks it's amazing. So it's not only is it not a detriment, it's something that he thinks is special. So
sure.
I don't know if Isaac wants to interject before I turn into like a Hallmark card over here.
I like it. That's great.
I would say I've had a very similar experience with Dorothy. I mean, to the extent that she's often helped lead, you know, the sort of identification of areas for improvement and the integration of new solutions and that kind of thing. She's has a very practical view of those things, and she tells me she likes spending time with me. I don't know. You know, the hardest thing for me, I think, really was and is, frankly, still is, you know, having children, particularly young children,
mm-hmm.
who like to, you know, horseplay and throw a ball and, you know, do all sorts of stuff that, you know, there are adaptive solutions and things like that for, but that doesn't mean they're easy.
Right.
Or even particularly enjoyable for someone mm-hmm. without sight. So, you know, for me, it's really more about the toughest thing for me is fears that I'm not, you know, enough for my children, or too much of one thing, not enough of the other, or, mm-hmm. you know, somehow limited in my abilities to be a father. Of course, you know, they assure me otherwise. They're very good children. They're very loving. I'm immensely proud of them.
And probably in many ways a fear that every parent has.
But it's easy
to name a very particular reason in your case, right?
You know,
it's easy,
Matt,
to say, this is my concern.
That's a very profound point you make there, Matt. And I think I have always felt like that precise point kind of lies at the distinction between trying to find power and strength in the experiences we go through versus vulnerability and weakness.
Mm.
And you could even make, one might even make the argument that we are fortunate to the extent that much of the fear and anxiety, fight or flight, all that subconscious stuff that's going on, you know, in the lizard brain,
mm-hmm.
That everybody has in this world.
Sure.
I mean, it's just part of being a human. We have the benefit of, you know, knowing the first place to look when we're trying to unpack it and sort it out and, you know, rise above. So, you know, it's, again, there's pros and cons to everything in life. Nothing is just bad or just good. I mean, things just are, and they have their, you know, positive and negative qualities or whatever. And so anyway, one of the benefits, I guess, of having something so severe as this, that is, on the one hand, lets you, like Dario was just saying, on the one hand, like, you know, lets you not sweat the small stuff, so to speak, which is phenomenal. You know, and on the other hand, with the not small stuff, the huge stuff, it's usually not a huge mystery where it's coming from. You can go first to that whole inner monologue of saying, okay, well, does this have to do with the fact that I'm confronting a situation without sight, or have confronted, and what exactly am I afraid of? And how exactly can I make it better for myself? And a lot of people don't have that luxury.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you two have figured out parenting first, because I hopefully one day I'll be calling you for advice. what would you say has been the hardest part?
I can't wait, Matt.
Yeah, well.
I'm all up in Matt's business.
don't hold your breath, Daria, but I appreciate your interest.
No, I'm very excited for the babies to come.
Right.
Matt had a shabby Stanford degree in electrical engineering career, so, you know, we're talking to a slacker. I do want to say one shout out, speaking of pros and cons. While on the one hand, it's terrifying, the thought of having, you know, three kids diagnosed, we had each other. So I want a shout out to our older sister, Alana, who we call Noosh, who also has RP and has been, of course, part of this journey with us. And then we have a younger sighted sister, Ro, who has navigated that role and has really been there for us. So I think we had so many blessings in that call. My parents, of course, who were amazing advocates for us. So I always just feel like we want to pay it forward, because we have so many gifts and resources and silver linings in our lives that a lot of people are not as fortunate to have, and that's really when it's a struggle, right? Eyes, like we talk about feeling a little bit like that imposter syndrome.
Yeah, absolutely. But,
yeah.
Look, I mean, most of the people in this world live on less than $1 a day. I mean, countless, one in six children in Orlando, Florida, lest you think this is a third world issue we're talking about here, one in six children in Orlando, Florida, Central Florida, is food insecure. You know, the most basic diseases that, you know, we've vanquished here in the States, or, you know, we are easily treatable, kill, you know, untold millions of people around the world every day. It's just hard to look at someone who's been, you know, in Daria, in my case, born to a middle-class family in America, to parents who loved us and nurtured us, cared for our education. You know, we had each other along the way, as Daria says. And you say, like, would I take the hand I was dealt in this sort of universe or whatever, and throw it back and draw another hand? And say, absolutely not.
Right.
That'd be crazy. Right. That would be a losing proposition. So then you go, well, then how bad can I feel for myself about this whole blindness stuff? And that's not to say that there aren't times when you do feel bad. It's only natural. You mourn, right? You mourn the things you've lost. You mourn the things you don't have.
For sure.
But I think to Darren, tell me if I'm way off base, but I think that's kind of some of what you're getting at in terms of, like, you know, who are we to complain or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's good to always keep that perspective. And of course, be able to have those, make room for the angry or rough moments, of course, but always with that perspective in the background keeps you on track, you know.
Right.
Which in all candor, I failed to do for a while. I don't think I left enough space for myself to say, yes, all of those things that I just said are true, and not but, this is the critical thing, and it can still really suck to be blind, and I can have bad days, and I can feel real lonely or frustrated or sad.
Yeah, you know, and there can be moments where you say, I really wish I could see X, Y, or Z. I wish I could see that, you know?
Matt, wait till you have kids.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I feel like
I've never seen
exploring
my children's faces.
I feel, Isaac, you're exploring that emotional piece more in recent years, and I'm so glad you're making room for that, you know? Yeah.
For sure. Well, you know, we have different strategies that work for us under different, you know, different periods of time. Also evolutionarily, mm-hmm. you know, we go through different phases that serve different, you know, purposes from an evolutionary biology basis or whatever. And so I think when you're in the like rush, go out there, you know, form your own tribe, you know, get the, you know, like, it's easy to just kind of say, okay, look, head down. You're luckier than everyone else around you. Get things done. But now, you know, with the luxury of some experience, hopefully some wisdom, certainly with my kids around, you know, it's important to open up. And like you said, dare enable some room in my life for just the sadness and the frustration and whatever, like everyone has.
Yeah.
And I struggled with this but and idea that I just kind of alluded to. In my mind, it almost seemed like to say I'm having a really hard day today site-wise and I'm a little depressed about it and I, you know, wish I could engage in this experience with my children with sight for a long time. That, to me, I would answer that with a yeah, but wait a minute, but stop it. Don't go there because you're one of the, you know, half the people in the world live on a dollar a day and all that and yada, yada, yada. And it's only recently that I've realized it's not a but, it's an and.
Right.
Which has, frankly, you know, to Darius' point, has thrown me for a bit of a loop in recent years, because all of a sudden I find maybe I'm mourning things that I sort of didn't take the time to do along the way.
Hmm.
You were also thrust into the limelight. I mean, achieving like wildly successful things, and you were like in this like inspiring mode. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I think that was part of it. You know, you there, kind of became no,
if you
this
got
sort
all of
like,
these other achievements happening, you don't feel like you should say, "Well, but there are these."
Right, there's this
part that's hard, and you kind of almost have to have the hero face on a little bit.
Yeah. I guess I guess that's true to an extent.
All right.
Although
I
challenge the use of the word hero. And
well, sure.
I mean, hero implies someone. I'm picturing like a, you know, like a comic book hero. You know, very rippled and well put together.
You know,
strong. Well,
you know, we're all blind here. Like you can tell us whatever you want. I mean,
exactly. A lot of blind listeners.
That's true.
Isaac is like the spitting image of Liam Hemsworth.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, good Lord. I don't even know who that is. Is that bad?
He's just a hunky actor.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Now you have to go ask somebody if that was a compliment or not.
No.
Actually, your kids will know. You're teenagers. But
Oh, gosh. All right, well, switching gears, obviously, both of you have had incredibly successful academic and professional careers. See if I have all this right. Dara, you studied piano at New World High School of the Arts in Miami, graduated from Harvard with a degree in psychology, and then went to Columbia School of Social Work for your MSW, and then decided to go on to Fordham Law School to get your law degree. And then Isaac graduated from Harvard at 19 with a degree in mathematics, Harvard Law School, clerked for 2 Supreme Court justices, just to, you know, step it up a little bit. But I like, as you say, Isaac, probably what people are most excited about is your starring role on NBC's Saved by the Bell, the new class.
Yeah.
So you guys haven't taken it easy at all.
The most. It's generally the only thing that people care about.
Oh gosh, so obviously neither of you have let RP slow you down, and what inspired both of you to go to law school?
I took a class on I took a class on social welfare policy when I was getting my MSW.
okay.
And I started thinking about law school. Our dad was a lawyer. Our mom had gone to law school when we were in high school.
Hmm.
But also, I figured I love school and I could push off real world life for another few years. So by that point, our parents were on to me. They were like, all right, that's enough school. Like, get a job. And but Isaac, it was more of a real passion, I would say, right?
Yeah, I grew up going to work with my dad a lot. My dad was a lawyer, solo practitioner, hung out a shingle for himself out of law school. Was very mm-hmm. ultimately became a very successful lawyer. Had sort of at its peak had five or six other attorneys working for him at his firm. And
okay,
he was kind of like the pit bull litigator type. it was amazing. People would come to my dad with their problems, friends, family, obviously his paying clients. I distinguished because he never charged friends or family. And they would come with what seemed like these big problems, and my dad would turn them into opportunities.
Right.
Financial opportunity for everyone.
And,
that's right.
And the results he would consistently produce for these folks and his clients was amazing. And anyway, he had a very much a one an extremely powerful analytical sort of a problem solving mind, and yet it's sort of also married to a mind that was able to sort of see past and around and through sort of constraints. If that makes sense.
Sure.
And so you could never win an argument with my dad, by his design. You never win a bet with my dad, by his design.
Right. And so you have to write the terms of the bet just perfectly.
I know, but he could always get around that.
There was a loophole always.
Oh,
that's
always,
right.
With his children, with his young children, he would literally do that.
Oh,
go into a restaurant, pull a waiter or waitress aside, off to the side and say, hey, listen, I'm going to order Diet Coke and I'm going to tell you I don't want any refills, but just keep hammering me with refills no matter what I tell you. And then he would bet us. He would say, I bet you I'm only going to order one Diet Coke today, for lunch. And we'd say, Pa, what are you talking about? You drink like five Diet Cokes for lunch. So, you take the bet. And then all of a sudden, like halfway through lunch, you realize that even though my dad's turning down refills, they're coming fast and furious. And you feel like an idiot. Anyway. But so I always wanted to learn how to think like my dad. And so law school first for me was very much a way to learn a mode of thinking. Not unlike math or computer science, mm-hmm. things I studied in college, just a different way of having a problem solving approach. So I sort of refer to it as my like joyride through law. I was blessed to go to Harvard Law and then I worked for the job. I had what's probably will be the best job I'll ever have. When it's kind of like one of your earliest jobs. But that was working for the Justice Department where I got to litigate appeals on behalf of the United States and its agencies and the federal appellate courts across the country. And it was just like an amazing job. And then the Supreme Court clerkship, which you mentioned, which was amazing. And then I had to sort of quote unquote grow up in the field of law and get a real job. And I just sort of followed the herd and followed the money, frankly, into a job with a huge, ginormous law firm. At which point I was like, okay, and law is over for me. That was a really nice chapter.
You did not like that.
It went great. And good luck to lawyers worldwide. I'm going to do something else.
Right. Now doing all of that, and in particular, my mind goes to working for justices on the Supreme Court. How are you accessing information? Was everything digital at that point? Or what was that like for you?
Yeah, everything was digital.
Okay.
At that point, and I, I can't stress enough that I had a tremendous amount of help. So yes, sure. The first blind person, the clerk for the Supreme Court or whatever, but I also, had the full support of the library staff at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has its own library for the justices and their clerks who do a lot of research, as you might imagine.
Sure.
And so, the IT folks, the technology staff work with the library to be able to like take a brief or whatever that came in from one of the parties in the case, let's say, and sort of pretty quickly extract all the cases that were cited by that brief.
Okay.
And then download those for me and put them in a folder and the right thing. And so I had, a small army of folks who were helping ensure that I always had at my fingertips in digital format anything that I needed to access, which was amazing. I mean, the other thing that's amazing too is when you call a publisher and you're like, hey, this textbook of yours, I'd love a digital copy of it.
Right.
I'm blind and I promise I won't send it to anyone. Like, they'll laugh at you, right?
Right. Right.
But when it's the Supreme Court calling and they're saying, hey, this is
they don't
Supreme
laugh
Court.
Anymore.
Like a digital copy. They don't. They send it. Like, and they send it quickly.
Right.
So, you know, I still have on my hard drive all these like legal treatises that are in like Microsoft Word format. That's like amazing because I can search them and I can actually access them or whatever.
That's incredible.
Guys, in my memory, though, you were helping them modernize along the way.
Well, right. So it was a collaborative process to develop this sort of system that I speak of. And it was they were so excited about it, which just made it, it's just such a heartwarming, just such a beautiful thing about sort of the beauty of the beauty of the human spirit can convey. The folks at the library were so excited about it, in particular the woman there who was leading the project. She wound up writing like a whole article about what we did and how we did it and whatever, that was published in what I'm told is a pretty legitimate, prestigious journal for librarians. Hmm. And so yeah, so it was cool. We did do something a little different there, I guess, that was noticed.
Sure. Now, Daria, what got you started looking at doing social work? I know we met in one of, I don't remember, was I in your first teen telesupport group?
You were in my first teen telesupport group.
So what got you going in that direction?
I love working with young people and with teens. And after law school, I was an elementary school counselor for years at a New York City school that was failing. Okay. I worked for an organization called Partnership with Children. They would place social work teams in schools that were failing. So,
okay.
So that was great. And then I had two kids back to back, 18 months apart. and I got a call one day. I met my Commission for the Blind social worker to look for services for myself. You know, I wasn't working at the time.
Sure.
And I met her, and then she called and she said, the Lighthouse Guild, you know, runs these telesupport groups. One of the facilitators had a terrible, you know, medical situation and had to leave. They're looking for someone. Can you come in and interview? And I remember telling my mom, of course I can. I have like two babies, 18 months apart. And she was like, of course you can. And you should. Like, what, like, you need to like have meaning and a job, you know, and do something. So I'm really glad I listened to my mom's advice that day, and I met the head of the program, and they hired me like on the spot, and now it's like over 17 years later, and it's been honestly just such an incredible experience. I feel like I get more out of it than the group members.
As always,
like you,
listen to mom, right?
Listen to mom. Well, that's a shout out to mom.
Well, I will say, as your sibling, I did notice you said, I'm really glad I listened to mom that day.
Exactly. I'm
there
pretty
was
stubborn.
The assertion
exactly.
of those two words.
He has the lawyer mind.
Isaac is telling on you.
Exactly. Isaac's getting me in trouble here. I'm trying to give a nice shout out and
honest.
Get some points. You're being honest.
Typical and lawyer. Isaac, typical lawyer.
Well, I'll point out another thing. Isaac is a guest speaker for my groups every year. He, you know, kindly says yes, and in my mind, he's just
I
loving
said,
this.
I said one day a year.
Exactly.
One night a year. Yeah.
And then I learned from his wife that he sees it as like going to the dentist once a year. And I was like, wow, that's something he has to do every year. He has to say yes to his sister. No, I'm teasing. You do a lot
of
work in the community. That's right.
I am now in one of her groups because Daria started a group for blind parents.
Right.
And I said, whoa. I mean, if you ask me to be a speaker to that one, I mean, I'm barely figuring it out myself. So I'd love to learn on that one. So
sure.
I actually joined that group. We meet on Monday.
Cool.
Yeah.
What groups do you have now, Daria? Well, the two, mainly, you know, the teen high school groups, but we also just launched a group for blind parents.
Okay.
And a group for people who are sighted who have a blind partner.
Okay.
But it's not for the part for the couple. It's just for the sighted person. So that's been really interesting to hear that perspective. I feel more like a voyeur in that group. we have several sighted partners in our family. So
right.
Yeah. But these group members are very open about, you know, the hardships of being married to someone who's, you know, low vision or blind, just like how it's, you know, it's tricky to navigate when you need to help, when you shouldn't help, all those kinds of issues that are.
Well, and we talked a little bit about, you know, finding someone who kind of looks past it, but just like we should have days where we can say it's really hard not to see, you know, we have to understand, I suppose, for them too. It's not always easy, you know.
So,
absolutely. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Gosh. All right. So just kind of the one other thing I was gonna ask, just because I was curious, you know, from my perspective, starting so young, Braille has just been so important to me. I started learning in first grade and really took off in third. And it's just been so important for me as a doing math or computer programming, things like that. And it's different for everyone. Everyone has a different situation. And I can only imagine, you know, losing your sight over time would be a factor. Have either of you learned Braille, and to what extent, why or why not? Just kind of curious.
I learned.
That's a great question, yeah.
I wish I knew Braille. I really do. Mm-hmm. And I've tried a couple times to dig into it, like the contracted Braille and all that and whatever. Mm-hmm. But I've never stuck with it. But I do read uncontracted Braille.
Sure.
Which critically enables me to continue my beloved poker poker games.
There we go.
And you know, buttons in an elevator and that kind of thing, but. No, I mean, like you said, I mean, it, as with everything in life, I mean, it's easier to learn when you're younger, and especially with languages, and right. Not making excuses or anything like that, but just the couple times that I've tried, it's just seemed like a long haul.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, my biggest thing is it's so hard to find a good teacher, because that can make such a difference.
Yeah.
You know, finding someone who knows it well and has an excitement about it can make it so much easier. I know the joke when I was young.
I tried to do it by myself, so maybe that's the problem.
So when I was young, my Braille teacher was, I think, in her 70s when I met her, living out on her own, kind of in the middle of nowhere up in Northern California. And, you know, we always laugh because we would sit at her dining room table and she'd have a Braille book there and she'd be reading, trying to find a passage for me. Slide it across the table and go, look at this. And I'd reach over to find her finger, you know.
Right.
So whenever somebody says, you know, hey, did you see? Oh, I'm so sorry. No, it's cool.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
We use visual terms. We're cool with that, right?
Exactly. Funny enough, her husband actually also went to law school, but he was born in, I think, 1916 and never could get anybody to hire him at that time.
Oh, wow.
So there seems to be a trend with blind people going to law school. I feel left out now.
it's never too late, Matt.
Nope. Yeah.
Especially
I don't like to read quite
Braille,
that much.
About it.
Yeah. Seriously.
But Daria, I believe you haven't learned. Have you done much with Braille?
No.
Or?
So by the time I lost the ability to read print,
right.
Like regular print, I would say was after law school.
Okay.
In my 20s, not that I couldn't have learned Braille, but by then a lot of the like Audible and all those technologies
right.
were booming.
For sure.
And seemed a heck of a lot easier. I mean, I'm pretty
in
awe that you read Braille, let's put it that way. So I've never even
Well,
tried.
They're different tools. And I mean, you know, I think for myself, just doing software development, things like that, I find Braille to be so important just because you're nitpicking every character, you know, so it'd be harder to listen to perhaps.
Interesting,
but,
right.
But they are all, I mean, great tools. I use all the same ones, so thank goodness we have all of them now.
Yeah, would you say electrical engineering would be a lot harder without Braille for you?
I mean, I spent college with, you know, when the accommodations group at Stanford would Braille the textbooks, they'd have all the diagrams and you know, circuit schematics and tables. And I had some that were, I would describe them as scrolls. I took one to the professor's office and held it up at my head and dropped it and it hit the floor and rolled. And he asked me how I read it. And I said, well, thankfully the house I'm living in has a pool table. So I take it down there and put balls on the corners to hold it flat. I can't imagine working with diagrams and things without that. But, But it's different. You know, I've known other, you know, obviously both of you and then other blind people who, you know, it just hasn't fit what they were doing or timing or whatever. There's all kinds of factors, but very cool.
Now awesome. I want to learn Braille, actually. This is what I'm thinking.
there we go. Awesome. Well, I guess, Daria, where can people find information on the support groups and things like that?
Oh, well, thanks for mentioning that. On the Lighthouse Guild website, you can find a ton of information about all of these free. They're totally free telesupport groups.
Awesome. And then, Isaac, I'll just refer people back to your TED Talk and then your book, which I think was Eyes Wide Open, correct?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much. This was awesome.
Matt, it's an honor to call you a friend. You are, both of you guys are totally inspiring in my book, so this has been very fun.
Awesome. And Isaac, I think we need to connect more because reading your book, I think we've got a lot of ideas that line up pretty darn well.
I love it. I love it, man. Let's do it.
Cool. All right. Thank you, guys.
If you would like to learn more, go to defendingvision.com. And if you enjoyed the show, rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening.